Hello, and welcome to Page Turn, the Largo Public Library podcast. I'm your host, Hannah. Page Turn is a monthly podcast bringing you information about great books, library news, and fun library tidbits from your favorite programs, as well as a Spanish language book review from Victor. But as always, we start with Reader's Advisory. When his mother became president, Alex Claremont Diaz was promptly cast as the American equivalent of a young royal. Handsome, charismatic, genius, his image is pure millennial marketing gold for the White House. There's only one problem. Alex has a beef with the actual prince, Henry, across the pond. When the tabloids get a hold of a photo involving an Alex-Henry altercation, U.S.-British relations take a turn for the worse. Heads of family, state, and other handlers devise a plan for damage control, staging a truce between the two rivals. What at first begins as a fake, Instagrammable friendship grows deeper and more dangerous than either Alex or Henry could have imagined. Soon, Alex finds himself hurtling into a secret romance with a surprisingly unstuffy Henry that could derail the campaign and upend two nations, and begs the question, can love save the world after all? Where do we find the courage and the power to be the people we are meant to be? And how can we learn to let our true colors shine through? Today's Reader's Advisory is Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston. Red, White, and Royal Blue is an alternate history political romance. The characters are well-developed, and the writing is engaging and witty. Dealing with the complexities of American and British politics, the story manages to be both heartwarming and steamy. Readers may also enjoy The Wedding Date by Jasmine Guillory. Agreeing to go to a wedding with a guy she gets stuck with in an elevator is something Alexa Monroe wouldn't normally do, but there's something about Drew Nichols that's too hard to resist. On the eve of his ex's wedding festivities, Drew is minus a plus one, until a power outage strands him with the perfect candidate for a fake girlfriend. After Alexa and Drew have more fun than they ever thought possible, Drew has to fly back to Los Angeles and his job as a pediatric surgeon, and Alexa heads home to Berkeley, where she's the mayor's chief of staff. Too bad they can't stop thinking about the other. They're just two high-powered professionals on a collision course toward the long-distance dating disaster of the century, or closing the gap between what they think they need and what they truly want. Or Pumpkinheads by Rainbow Rowell. Deja and Josiah are seasonal best friends. Every autumn, all through high school, they've worked together at the best pumpkin patch in the whole wide world. Not many people know that the best pumpkin patch in the whole wide world is in Omaha, Nebraska, but it definitely is. They say goodbye every Halloween, and they're reunited every September 1st. But this Halloween is different. Josiah and Deja are finally seniors, and this is their last season at the pumpkin patch. Their last shift together, their last goodbye. Josiah's ready to spend the whole night feeling melancholy about it. Deja isn't ready to let him. She's got a plan. What if, instead of moping and the usual slinging lima beans down at the Succotash hut, they went out with a bang? They could see all the sights, taste all the snacks, and Josiah could finally talk to that cute girl he's been mooning over for 3 years. What if their last shift was an adventure? Or Boyfriend Material by Alexa Hall. Wanted. One fake boyfriend, practically perfect in every way. Luke O'Donnell is tangentially and reluctantly famous. His rockstar parents split when he was young, and the father he's never met spent the next 20 years cruising in and out of rehab. Now that his dad's making a comeback, Luke's back in the public eye, and one compromising photo is enough to ruin everything. To clean up his image, Luke has to find a nice, normal relationship, and Oliver Blackwood is as nice and normal as they come. He's a barrister, an ethical vegetarian, and he's never inspired a moment of scandal in his life. In other words, perfect boyfriend material. Unfortunately, Apart from being gay, single, and really, really in need of a date for a big event, Luke and Oliver have nothing in common. So they strike a deal to be publicity-friendly fake boyfriends until the dust has settled. Then they can go their separate ways and pretend it never happened. But the thing about fake dating is that it can feel a lot like real dating. And that's when you get used to someone, start falling for them, don't ever want to let them go. Bonus segment! My personal favorite Goodreads list, Red, White, and Royal Blue is on, is books that make you vomit with joy. Happy reading, everyone! Today's library tidbit is about the history of the Native American population in Pinellas County and the surrounding areas. This is going to be a survey-level history tidbit, and I will be covering a lot of history very quickly, so keep in mind that if you would like to know more, there is more to learn. The first people to live in the area were Paleo-American peoples. We don't know as much about them as we do later people groups, as many of the artifacts that they would have left behind have either decayed with age or are underwater, the Florida coastline being much different then than now. Much of what we know about the Paleo-American people in Florida come from archaeologists doing underwater excavating in springs. The first people arrived in Florida during the time of the Pleistocene megafauna. Think mammoths, giant tortoises, and bison antiquus. Paleo-Americans used stone tools including spear points, blades, scrapers, gouges. Archaeologists have also discovered ivory, antler, shell, and wood tools, including eyed needles, pins, mortars, and throwing sticks or boomerangs. The closest site to Pinellas County that has been discovered and excavated is the Harney Flat site in Hillsborough County. The next distinct culture that we have an archaeological record for is the Minnesota culture. The Minnesota are named for the modern names given to the area that they mostly lived in, Manatee and Sarasota. It's important to keep in mind that most names for prehistoric peoples are names given to them by modern people, probably white people, who have no familiar or ethnic connection to them. The most famous archaeological site for the Minnesota in Pinellas County, at what is now the St. Pete Clearwater Airport, is named Yat Katishi, a Muscogee name that means red people. Muscogee is one of two official languages of the Seminole tribe. Originally, the site was named Moak Midden after the electronics plant that was nearby. The Minnesota culture was fully adapted to coastal life. Archaeological sites have been found along estuaries and near bays for easy access to fish and shellfish, as well as along rivers for access to plants and land animals. There is evidence that they hunted and fished with spears and harpoons with bone and stone points. They may also have used bow and arrow for fishing and hunting as well, though there is less archaeological evidence to suggest that. Most of what we know about the Minnesota culture revolves around their burial rites. Older Minnesota burial plots are found near settlements and do not hold any grave goods or evidence of preferential treatment for the dead. This suggests a more egalitarian culture, however, we do not know this for certain. As time passed, the Minnesota adopted the mortuary practices of surrounding cultures, which included some ceremonial or religious burial practices. Around 200 AD, there is evidence that the Minnesota adopted the religious practices of Whedon Island. First, the Minnesota adopted the practices of burial mounds for their dead, but later they also adopted the practice of burying their dead with grave goods. We do not have direct evidence for what happened to the Minnesota culture, but it is believed that they were assimilated into the Safety Harbor culture, which appeared around 900 AD. The Safety Harbor culture is named from an archaeological site in Safety Harbor, which is in turn named for being a safe harbor from pirates in the 18th century. Unlike the Minnesota, which were believed to be more or less egalitarian, the Safety Harbor culture was very stratified. Evidence shows that they had a noble/ruling class, a warrior class, a peasant class, and also slaves. The culture was a chiefdom culture, which would have had a principal town with a temple mound and a central plaza. There have been 15 chieftains discovered ranging from southern Pasco to northern Sarasota, and from east to west covers the entire Tampa Bay area. Most chieftains were along the coast, and only one has been found inland so far. The chieftain of Tokabega is located in Philippi Park in Safety Harbor, and you can visit the site. What remains are a large temple mound, a smaller burial mound, and two shell middens. Records indicate that Tokabega was a major power in the Safety Harbor culture, and the entire culture is often referred to using just this chieftain. The Safety Harbor people did not survive contact with the Spanish and the diseases that they brought with them. There's a gap of about 100 years between Native American cultures as Native Americans fought against the destruction brought upon them by white colonizers. The dominant culture in Florida that emerged were named the Seminoles, and this culture exists to today. This name is derived from the Muscogee word Seminole, which may or may not have come from the Spanish word Cimarron, both of which can be translated as runaway or wild one. The Seminole tribe is largely derived from the Muscogee tribe. The Muscogee were originally from southern Tennessee, Alabama, western Georgia, and northern Florida. However, when the British invaded their lands, the Muscogee were forced to flee the violent south and farther into Florida. The Spanish colonizers who controlled Florida at that time may have invited them in the hopes that they would side with the Spanish against the English. This tenuous relationship with the Spanish lasted through the American Revolutionary War. In a truly baffling bit of history, the Treaty of Paris transferred the control of Florida from Spain to Great Britain in 1763. Then, the Peace of Paris Treaty transferred the control of Florida back to Spain in 1783. In those 20 years, Florida had been turned into two separate territories, West Florida and East Florida. But that's not really important to today. I bring up this interesting bit of history to note that then U.S. General Andrew Jackson made the decision to invade Spanish territory to wage the First Seminole War. The U.S. was also at war with Britain at the time, and in a weird twist, the British recruited Native Americans in Spanish-occupied territory to fight against the U.S. Weird, and that Great Britain was also waging a war against Spain at the time, so they were stretching themselves to potentially help the Spanish, which was a choice. Throughout its entire existence, the Seminole tribe welcomed in black individuals who had escaped slavery or freemen who found more community with Native Americans than with the Spanish. The existence of the black Seminoles and communities of free black people in Florida was a large component of why the Seminole Wars happened. That and the desire to conquer and colonize more land by the United States. The leaders of the U.S. were concerned that having large communities of free black people living so close to their borders would encourage the enslaved population to revolt or run away. I don't have the expertise to go into the full history or even a bit of the history of the Seminole Wars, but I will highlight the major events around the Tampa Bay area. After the end of the First Seminole War, Andrew Jackson decided to attack Angola, a prosperous community of escaped slaves that existed for years near what is now called Bradenton, as far as anyone can tell, simply for existing. Most of the free people who lived there were enslaved, but others escaped to the Bahamas where they continued to practice Seminole traditions. The Second Seminole War started because the United States government, spearheaded by then-President Andrew Jackson, decided to force relocate the Seminole tribe to Oklahoma. Naturally, the Seminoles resisted this demand. On December 23, 1835, Major Francis Langhorne Dade was taking two companies of American soldiers from what is now Tampa to what is now Ocala. On the way, Seminoles attacked them, killing all but three of the soldiers. While skirmishes had not ever really ended between the First and Second Seminole Wars, see the attack on Angola, this is the event that is credited for officially starting the Second Seminole War. By the Third Seminole War, the Seminole population had been pushed farther and farther south and inland, or they had been forced to relocate to Oklahoma, creating two different Seminole tribes. The Third Seminole War was more a series of skirmishes than any formal battles, as the Seminoles were excellent at guerrilla warfare, hitting the U.S. troops and then disappearing into the Florida landscape, where the U.S. soldiers were unable to follow. The U.S. decided that the way to win the war was to destroy the Seminoles' food supplies. Facing starvation, the majority of the remaining Seminoles agreed to leave Florida for Oklahoma. However, a population fled into the swamps, and the descendants of the Seminoles who refused to leave their land make up the current Seminole tribe. This is an incredibly short history of Native American life in the Tampa Bay area. There's a lot more to the history and a lot more to the people who once lived here. We have several books on the Seminole tribe upstairs. Check out call numbers 900.3, and for more information on Black Seminoles, check out the call number 973.04. And now it's time for Book Traveler with Victor.
Bienvenidos a una nueva edición de Viajero de Libros. Mi nombre es Victor y soy bibliotecario de la comunidad en la Biblioteca Pública de Largo. Hoy les voy a hablar sobre un libro que tenemos en la colección en español que se titula Rojo Blanco y Sangre Azul, por Casey McQuinston. Resumen. El amor verdadero no siempre es diplomático. Alex Claremont Díaz, el hijo millennial de la presidenta de los Estados Unidos, es un tesoro para el marketing de la Casa Blanca. Es atractivo, carismático e inteligente. Lo que nadie sabe es que no soporta al príncipe Henry, el hijo de la reina de Inglaterra. Así que cuando la prensa sensacionalista se hace con una fotografía que refleja un altercado entre Alex y Henry, las relaciones entre Estados Unidos y el Reino Unido se enfrían. Ambos países trazan un plan para paliar los daños, lo que empieza como una falsa amistad, publicada en Instagram, se va transformando en algo más profundo de lo que Alex y Henry podrían haber imaginado. ¿Puede el amor cambiar el mundo? Mi opinión. El libro fue recomendado por un bibliotecario aquí en la biblioteca, y a pesar de no haber escuchado nada de él antes, tuve que leerlo después de ver tantas reseñas positivas. Leí la versión en inglés, y tan pronto salió la traducción al español, tuve que leerla también. En mi opinión, el libro es muy tierno, donde, a pesar de algunas dificultades, todo es muy idealista. Es un mundo alterno donde muchos queremos vivir. Todo empieza con la rivalidad de Alex, el hijo de la primera mujer presidenta de los Estados Unidos, y Henry, el príncipe de Inglaterra. Esta rivalidad se va desarrollando hasta convertirse en algo más. Rojo, Blanco y Sangre Azul nos lleva a Washington, en Estados Unidos, donde Alex Claremont Díaz es el primer hijo presidencial, junto a su hermana June y su mejor amiga y exnovia, Nora. Ellos forman el trío de oro de la Casa Blanca. Entre sus obligaciones de socialites está la de formar lazos internacionales. Es ahí cuando Alex va a una boda real en Inglaterra y tiene el altercado con Henry. Forman tan gran escena que las fotografías del altercado entre Alex y Su Alteza Real, el príncipe Henry de Gales, dan vuelta al mundo, lo que amenaza las relaciones estadounidenses y británicas. El grupo que maneja las relaciones de la presidenta le dice que tiene que arreglar el problema y ahora deben fingir ser mejores amigos para calmar las aguas. Mientras los detractores de la presidenta quieren echar por tierra su reelección y las aspiraciones políticas de Alex se ven en peligro, lo que menos necesita es problemas con el príncipe. Así que ambos chicos aceptan. Al empezar a fingir ser amigos, se empiezan a ver más seguidos. Van a almuerzos, reuniones sociales, eventos especiales, hasta que poco a poco va creciendo entre ellos algo más que una rivalidad. Ambos se sorprenderán al descubrir en ellos que hay una persona más profunda de la que dicen los medios. Por ello que la campaña inminente, Alex y Henry se ven en medio de una relación secreta que podría derrumbar a ambas naciones. Algo que no me gustó de la traducción fue el uso de algunas palabras románticas que no son normalmente usadas entre personas de 20 años. Aunque también puede depender de la persona que hizo la traducción, ya que el español tiene muchos vocabularios diferentes. No voy a hablar más de la trama para no dar el final, pero es un libro muy recomendado, en especial para el mes del orgullo gay. Es todo por hoy, hasta la próxima edición de Viajero de Libros. Hasta luego.
Thanks, Victor, for another great book review. Remember, if you happen to not know Spanish, check out the English language translation in the show notes. And if you were particularly interested in today's Reader's Advisory, especially check out the English language translation in the show notes. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Remember to check out our virtual programming. We hope you're staying safe out there. We hope to talk to you again soon. Succotash. Whatever, I'm going to pronounce it that way.